From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Condon about writing and directing his new film, Kinsey, based on the life and work of Alfred Kinsey, who asked people to tell him about the most intimate parts of their lives for his scientific research into human sexuality. His 1948 book, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, changed the way people think about sex. Liam Neeson stars as Kinsey. Bill Condon also wrote and directed Gods and Monsters and wrote the screenplay for the musical Chicago. Also, we remember Leroy Ahrens, the founder of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. He died last weekend at the age of 70. In 1990, he commissioned a groundbreaking survey of gay and lesbian reporters, many of whom had been afraid to come out of the closet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President George Bush is in Ottawa today on his first official visit to Canada. At a joint press conference with the Canadian Prime Minister, the president sought to patch up the strained relationship between the two countries. Richard Reynolds reports.
President Bush thanked Prime Minister Paul Martin so many times during his statement that the Prime Minister appeared embarrassed. It was a clear sign that the hard feelings which infected the Canada-U.S. relationship after Canada's refusal to join the U.S. in its war in Iraq were now mostly a thing of the past. For Canadians, whose economy is utterly reliant on trade with the U.S., the President told Canadians he understood.
23% of America's exports come into your nation. More than 80% of Canada's exports go into my country. Trade is important.
The president also talked about border security, the issue that was likely at the top of his agenda. He indicated that Canada and the U.S. had made progress. Overall, the meeting produced no concrete advancements, but lots of goodwill. For NPR News, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
Iraqi rebels attacked U.S. troops today north of Baghdad. NPR's Philip Reeves reports that the violence is surging ahead of Iraq's scheduled elections.
There are exactly 2 months before the Iraqi elections are due to be scheduled, and the violence is continuing. A car bomb exploded near a U.S. military patrol in Beji, which is north of Baghdad. It's a Sunni town with a reputation of being a stronghold of supporters of Saddam Hussein. It's reported that this killed at least 7 Iraqis, according to doctors and the military. There were also problems in a separate attack. There was a rocket-propelled grenade attack on a U.S. tank in the same town. Beji's seen a lot of trouble in recent weeks, and this appears to be a continuation of it.
NPR's Philip Reeves in Baghdad. Representatives from several Middle Eastern countries are meeting in Iran to discuss neighboring Iraq's border security. NPR's Ivan Watson says the meetings are part of an ongoing process.
They have gathered in the past at the foreign minister level. Top diplomats have met from these countries about 6 times. This is the first meeting of its kind for law enforcement officials. And the reason they're gathering here, along with the UN delegation, is they're all supposed to try to work together to figure out a way to help stabilize Iraq. The Iraqi interim government, which is of course backed by the U.S., claims that foreign fighters and weapons are trickling across its borders. The neighboring countries, they insist they are against this, and they pledge to work with the Iraqi government to help fix this situation.
NPR's Ivan Watson in Tehran. Tom Ridge said today that he'll step down as Secretary of Homeland Security. Ridge, who's 59, said he plans to spend more time with his family after leaving office the 1st of February. In stocks, the Dow lost 47 to close at 10,428. The Nasdaq was down 10 to 2096. This is NPR News. Today marks the end of the Atlantic hurricane season. This year set records with 4 major storms making landfall in quick succession. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports that the impacts are still being felt.
The high cost of tomatoes today is a direct result of hurricanes Charley, Francis, Ivan, and Jean. So is the dearth of grapefruits in supermarkets across the country. 2 of this year's storms came ashore in the region of Florida that produces the vast majority of the country's citrus crop. This year's hurricanes also drenched cotton fields in Georgia and Alabama, and they blew apart nurseries. Nursery plants are Florida's number 2 industry, right behind tourism, which also took a hit when Hurricane Francis buffeted the state over Labor Day weekend. People in Florida and other Gulf Coast states are also still recovering from the storms. More than 200,000 are living in hotels or temporary housing. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has extended its deadline for people to apply for federal aid to mid-December. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Miami.
A senior British official said today that the U.S. policy on prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay prison camp in Cuba is unacceptable. Lord Charles Falconer said it was unacceptable for the U.S. to try to put detainees beyond the reach of the law by holding them in Cuba. Falconer told reporters in London today that the U.S. Supreme Court was right in ruling that the Bush administration must allow the detainees access to lawyers. Four British citizens are among the prisoners held at Guantanamo. Most of them were captured in Afghanistan and are accused of supporting the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. The Red Cross has sent the Bush administration a report on conditions faced by the detainees at Guantanamo that's said to be highly critical. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo USA, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Condon, wrote and directed the new film Kinsey, based on the life of Alfred Kinsey, who conducted groundbreaking research into human sexuality. In the 40s, Kinsey was a biology professor who studied the gall wasp and found that no two wasps were the same. He decided to expand his research to humans, specifically to the study of human sexuality, a subject that was considered taboo. His 1948 book, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, was based on thousands of interviews with people about the most intimate parts of their lives. He followed that up with a book about female sexuality. His work was enormously controversial in its time and remains so among those people who believe he opened the door to sexual amorality. Filmmaker Bill Condon also wrote and directed Gods and Monsters, and he wrote the screenplay for the musical Chicago. Here's a scene from Kinsey after Kinsey has decided to investigate human sexuality and teach a course on marriage. He's in the classroom. Kinsey is played by Liam Neeson.
Why offer a marriage course? Because society has interfered with what should be a normal biological development, causing a scandalous delay of sexual activity, which leads to sexual difficulty in early marriage. In an uninhibited society, a 12-year-old would know most of the biology, which I will have to give you in formal lectures. So, let's start with the six stages of the coital sequence. Both sexes experience all six stages equally. Stimulation. Who can tell me which part of the human body can enlarge 100 times? Miss.
I'm sure I don't know. And you've no right to ask me such a question in a mixed class.
I was referring to the pupil of your eye, young lady. And I think I should tell you, you're in for a terrible disappointment.
I spoke with filmmaker Bill Condon about his movie and Kinsey's research. You might not find our discussion appropriate for children. I asked Condon how Kinsey got people to respond candidly to his questionnaire about their sexual histories, when they would be unlikely to feel comfortable discussing such an intimate subject with friends or spouses.
One of the most original things about the methodology was that he always assumed you had done everything. So it was never, have you ever, you know, masturbated. It was, when was the first time you masturbated? With every question, the burden of kind of admission was taken off of you. It was just assumed you had done it all. So there was an extremely non-judgmental approach. He also had these ways of bringing the questions back to the same place over and over again, and really being able to test whether your answers were consistent, you know. So he worked in a lot of tripwires to weed out the liars and the exaggerators, which of course is one of the real problems with taking sex histories. And you know, in general, having collected these 8 million gall wasps, he was trying to apply the same idea to sex. If I can just get more than anybody else, his aim was to get 100,000. He actually wound up getting about 28,000, but that's still more than anybody had or has since then.
You know, do you think that even though he got thousands and thousands of people to respond to his survey, do you think that they were a representative sample of either Americans or of people in general in their approaches to sex?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think, first of all, it's nothing more than a snapshot of the country at the time, you know, so that the male volume really represents men during World War II,
mm-hmm.
And the female that, and a little later. No, you know, he'd solved one of the big challenges facing sex researchers, but in doing so created another problem. You know, the challenge was inevitably somebody who's going to talk to you about his or her sex life is probably more sexually comfortable and active than people who won't. So therefore, you know, the data might already be skewed in a certain direction. He came up with this idea with the help actually of Ray Kroc's brother, the founder of McDonald's, that they would get 100% groups. They would get people who'd gotten together for a reason that had nothing to do with sex, a bowling league or a lady sewing circle, and get 100% of those people to give their sex histories, actually using tactics that, you know, no one could get away with today. You know, the first 40 or 50% would fall in pretty easily. Then he'd use them to convince, you know, the next 20 or 30%. And the holdouts really were subjected to threats. They were no longer going to be in the bowling league or the sewing circle and late-night phone calls until finally everybody agreed to do it. So
talk about peer pressure.
Exactly. So he felt if I just get enough of these groups, then it has to all add up to a kind of representative sample of America. And of course, that wasn't true. You know, he oversampled in certain groups, too many inmate histories, for example, something that he corrected in the female volume. Everybody always raises this issue of 10% of males being homosexual, you know, and Kinsey actually never said that. Kinsey actually thought, again, for him, homosexual was an adjective describing acts. He thought on the sixth end of his scale, people who were involved in exclusively homosexual acts, that was anywhere from 2 to 4% of the population, which basically falls in line with what people think today. What he did say was that 10% of the population had exclusively homosexual activity for 3 years in their adulthood. Now, you have to remember, again, snapshot of a time and a place. This is America during wartime, A, and B, at a time when most schools were single sex. So these are things that wouldn't apply today. But that's an example of something where a strict look at his data comes up with basically the same result as what people come up with today.
One of the questions that you have him asking in the movie, a question I really like that isn't directly related to sex, is this: how young were you when you no longer
Yes.
thought of your parents' home as your own? And there's two things I really like about that question. One is that it doesn't say how old were you, it says
Yes.
how young were you.
Yeah.
And the other is that, like, what a really interesting question to ask. Like, at
I
what
know.
Point it's did you realize this is no longer what you're about, or the
Exactly.
center of your life? You've moved on to becoming an adult person, a differentiated person.
I know. I love that question, too. And it was obviously, sort of a real find for, when I was writing the script, because it allows you to sort of deal with so much in the context of sexuality. And that's what he would do. He would ease in with these biographical questions and then slowly start to expand so that you got a question like that that isn't directly about sex, but in some basic way is, because
mm-hmm.
obviously that differentiation does happen during adolescence, during the onset of adolescence.
Now, you interviewed one of Kinsey's researchers as background
Yes.
for the screenplay. What are some of the things, like which researcher was it, and what were some of the things
Yeah.
you learned either about the research or about Kinsey's own life?
It was Paul Gebhardt, the character played by Tim Hutton in the movie. And actually, we had a wonderful screening the other day at the Kinsey Institute at IU for over 1,200 people, and he was there. And I was so relieved to talk with him afterwards and get his seal of approval. You know, the thing that struck me more than anything about him was the absolute sense of openness and the non-judgmental nature of talking to him. Here I was in this sort of awkward position of interviewing the ultimate interviewer and having to ask, pretty jump in and ask some pretty, intimate questions. What was sex night like at the Kinseys, for example? And he was so matter-of-fact about it all, about the affair that he'd had with one of the other researchers' wives when he first arrived in Bloomington, the effect that had on his marriage. It was, again, so open that I really got a glimpse into how these guys pulled it off, There's just something so matter-of-fact about everything that was discussed.
What is sex night at the Kinseys?
It wasn't that frequent, but they did get into Kinsey, did start to promote this idea of open marriages and kind of a sex, a life where everyone would sort of enjoy each other and kind of, you know, trying to strip away all the other things that that kind of go with that. You know, it was one of the kind of wackier things he tried, you know. And Kinsey's somebody who fell into this study, you know, started talking to people about sex, traveling the country talking to them about it, then started observing it, then started filming it, and then finally sort of, you know, went into this to this further point of kind of trying to actually create this sexual, I wouldn't call it utopia, but a certain sexual environment where everything would be open, you know, kind of a swinger way before his time, you know.
This is one of the things that a lot of people find very troubling about his life, because, you know, he's not exactly like the dispassionate scientist just observing behavior under the microscope. He's trying out a lot of things himself, a lot of things that were perceived as definitely violating, you know, the moral code of the time.
That's correct. And I think that's the trouble I think people get into. You know, they very quickly then say that the work was agenda driven, for example. And there's I really have found no proof for that idea. His first passion was science. You know, the idea of having collected these gall wasps and that he could collect as many human beings was for him more important than anything. Work was more important than anything, you know. But I think, you know, it's a problem that people who work in this area really face, because everyone sort of applies their own kind of code to other people's behavior. So especially when they hear that he was actually having all this extracurricular activity, there's immediately people leap to the conclusion that that's what the whole point of it was. And there's really that is not the case.
The way you portray him in the movie, he's somebody who is very scientifically interested in sex and becomes very interested in the pursuit of sex himself. But that the way you portray him, he's kind of emotionally tone deaf to the consequences that sex can have. For instance, if you're married and then you have relations with somebody outside of that marriage,
yes,
your spouse is likely to be upset. And he's a little uncomprehending about those kinds of emotional consequences. Is that based on research that you did about him?
Absolutely. You know, uncomprehending, impatient, you know, so driven by this work. And again, these are, I think that anyone who's unsympathetic to him will find plenty in this portrait to kind of confirm that point of view. You know, he is a complicated character, you know, a complicated person. And that was absolutely a part of it. The, you know, again, starting with the idea of studying sex scientifically, which meant for him outlets, namely orgasms, and then, you know, stripping away religion and morality and culture from that, and then extending that idea further and further into his own life, until it became almost a mission with him, is something that is understandably, you know, upsetting for people. I think you have to kind of have a complicated view of the world to really kind of countenance the whole picture, you know.
My guest is Bill Condon. He wrote and directed the new film Kinsey, which stars Liam Neeson and Laura Linney. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Bill Condon wrote and directed the new film Kinsey. It's based on the life and work of Alfred Kinsey, who conducted pioneering research into human sexuality. Here's an example of a scene that describes a side of Kinsey's life that a lot of people would find disturbing. His wife walks in on him as he's sitting on the edge of the bathtub in his robe, and there's blood dripping from between his legs, and he explains that he's just circumcised himself. Explain what's happened here.
Well, toward the end, Kinsey, who dabbled in a lot of things to try to understand them, did get involved in certain masochistic acts. And again, this is the truth. And I think, you know, it's a movie's job or a dramatist's job to try to understand that. And in the scene that you're describing, he has his own explanation, which is, you know, I just wanted to experience it, you know, it was the explanation that he would give to people. She immediately sees it in a different way. You know, she says, don't stop punishing yourself. This comes at a low point, you know, toward the end of his life when the female volume's been attacked and his funding's been slashed and he's under, you know, the cloud of a court case. And he feels that the work has kind of been a dead end and been a failure, you know. So she sees it more clearly as an attempt to punish himself. And I think the movie itself has yet another explanation, which is, I believe, you know, and I think this is kind of common. You know, I think it's common in artists, for example. But you look at Kinsey as somebody who self-described as someone who was tormented and damaged by this very repressive childhood and extremely intolerant father, you know. And one of the lessons of that father was about the shame of sex. And so what happens? He liberates himself. He discovers nature and science and all these things that make him treat those ideas as mumbo-jumbo, you know. Then he starts in on this mission, which he hopes will save other people. He said this over and over from the torment that he experienced. But what happens to that voice of shame? It doesn't just disappear. You can't, you know, like an artist going deeper and deeper into a subject and then sharing what they discover with the world, it doesn't mean that those wounds are healed necessarily. And it the way I read it, and I think the movie presents it, is that it's the kind of reincarnation of that sense of shame, you know, of the prudery that the father represented, you know, and at a very weak moment, kind of, you know, really, really punishing himself.
Now, you're talking about his repressive father. There's a scene in the movie in which he basically does a sex survey with his own father, and the father explains that as a way to punish him for masturbating and to prevent him from doing it further, this harness was created for him so that he could no longer do this.
Right.
And it becomes clear in the movie that this is why, one of the reasons why he became so repressed and intolerant and was so repressive in the way he brought up his son. But although that story was told to Kinsey, it wasn't told to Kinsey by his father. It was somebody else who he was administering the survey to who told him.
That's correct.
That story.
Who also had a similar kind of repressive trait. So, that is me combining two ideas. Kinsey always wishing he'd taken his father's history and never having had a chance to do it, and speculating about something like that about his father, and then this one subject. For me, it's less about Kinsey than a whole position, you know. But the fact that there was no breakthrough with the father, that is dramatic license. There's no question.
There are several religious websites right now that are protesting your movie and are outraged that Kinsey should be discussed in a way other than condemning him. I'll quote a couple of things. The Catholic Outreach website writes, "A committed atheist, Kinsey was determined to undermine the traditional moral climate of America and pave the way for widespread acceptance of all kinds of perversity, including pedophilia and bestiality. On the website of Concerned Women for America, this is written, he believed that all sexual behaviors were natural, including bestiality, pedophilia, homosexuality, sodomy, and sadistic sex. He argued that sex and morality had no connection." Have you been keeping up with the websites?
I have, you know, and I think the only thing that's accurate there in what you quoted was a committed atheist, you know. There are groups that have just demonized him over the years, again, with charges like pedophile, which, of course, are completely untrue. He was, it's this distinction that people seem unwilling to make between speaking to a pedophile and then using the data and supporting or promoting pedophilia or sex with animals or anything else, you know. Sometimes you just wish they would be more honest about their real concerns, you know, which I think in general, it's everything that's happened over the last 50 years, which they kind of, attribute all to Kinsey, which I think is really giving him much too much credit. But, you know, for example, today there's someone called Judith Reisman who's been writing about him for years and really is the source of these pedophilia charges. And just to put them in context, you know, here's a little excerpt from the talk of the town in this morning's New Yorker. To a reader of Reisman's scholarly papers, it sometimes appears that there is little for which she does not hold Kinsey responsible. In her research on gays, for instance, she's written that the recruitment techniques of homosexuals rival those of the Marine Corps. The Kinsey paradigm, she holds, created the moral framework that makes such recruitment possible. Reisman also endorses a book called The Pink Swastika, which challenges the myths that gays were victimized in Nazi Germany. The Nazi Party and the Holocaust itself, she writes, were largely the creation of the German homosexual movement. Thanks to Alfred Kinsey, she warns, the American homosexual movement is poised to repeat those crimes. Idealistic gay youth groups are being formed and staffed in classrooms nationwide by recruiters too similar to those who formed the original Hitler Youth. That's the level that you're dealing with, the level of reality, basically. But again, charges which are accurate, for example, you quoted avowed atheists, this was true, are thrown in with charges like pedophile, which have no basis in fact. And over the years, things that have become more culturally palatable, like a supporter of Planned Parenthood or of abortion or of homosexual, of tolerance of homosexuals, have sort of fallen by the wayside, and they've landed on this one charge for which, you know, there is no gray area in our culture, nor should there be, pedophilia. So it's a little frustrating because you're not dealing on a rational level with somebody. You're just dealing with these made-up charges.
Bill Condon wrote and directed the new film Kinsey. He also wrote and directed Gods and Monsters, which won an Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. He wrote the screenplay for the musical Chicago, which won 6 Academy Awards. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. I'd like to coo with my baby tonight. I'd pitch the woo with my baby tonight. But brother, you fight my baby tonight, 'cause it's too darn high. According to the Kinsey Report, every average man you know much prefers his lovey-dovey to court when the temperature is low. But when the thermometer goes way up and the weather is sizzling hot, Mr. Pants for romance is not, 'cause it's too, too, too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too, too darn hot.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Mark Summers' new illustrated edition of Poems and Tales by Edgar Allan Poe, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Leroy Ahrens, the founder of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. He died last weekend at age 70. In 1990, he commissioned a groundbreaking survey of gay and lesbian reporters, many of whom had been afraid to come out of the closet. We'll listen back to a 1992 interview. Also, we continue our interview with Bill Condon about writing and directing the new film, Kinsey. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Condon. He wrote and directed the new film Kinsey, which stars Liam Neeson as the controversial scientist who researched human sexuality in the 1940s and 50s. Alfred Kinsey was controversial in his time and remains controversial among those people who believe he condoned and encouraged sexual amorality. I spoke with filmmaker Bill Condon about his movie and Kinsey's research. You might not find our discussion appropriate for children. When we left off, we were discussing some of the websites that have condemned Kinsey, the man and the movie. There were people picketing at, certainly at a theater in Philadelphia, although I don't think the pickets lasted very long. But has this been happening around the country, that there were pickets, at least for the early screenings of Kinsey?
Yeah, I was just in St. Louis and did a book signing there at a Borders, and there were a number of people outside. None of whom had seen the movie, by the way. A friend of mine went out and asked, and everyone said, no, of course they hadn't seen it. And I guess, you know, that's always the disappointing thing. And it's an odd position to be in, because I think, you know, people think people make movies just want any kind of publicity, any kind of controversy. But it's a little different here, because if you look at the movies that, you know, have had this kind of controversy swirling around them in the last year, like The Passion of the Christ or Fahrenheit 9/11, they were about Jesus Christ or about George Bush. These are, you know, these are people have made up their minds about those people. But Kinsey is somebody who's still, you know, who's basically forgotten, you know, much of a celebrity as he was in his day. I think, you know, he's just a footnote for most people now. So it's just frustrating to think that, again, people with pickets and these words on them, very much like communists in the 50s, to my mind. You know, it's just convincing people just to stay away. You know, some of these people, Dr. Laura Schlesinger, went on the O'Reilly Factor a couple of years before he started shooting, you know, asking people, you know, to write in and try to stop this movie from being made. You know, they tried to take an ad in Variety, which, to its credit, didn't run it. But you know, over the years, Liam Neeson's mother has gotten letters from people, sort of, you know, egged on by these websites. So it's just a shame that they just are so afraid of the talk, basically, you know, just are letting people make up their own minds.
So what impact have those efforts to either prevent you from making the film or prevent people from seeing the film, and to discredit Kinsey's research, what impact has that had on you personally, or on your ability to make, you know, on the ease with which you were able to make the movie?
Yeah. You know, ultimately, it was a tough movie to get financed, and it's very hard to know what all went into that. You know, it's a film that the script I finished in 2000, and it took us 3 years to get the money together. And, you know, I assume part of that did have to do with the controversy surrounding him, you know, but a lot of other things, too. It's just hard to get a, you know, a kind of drama made at a, you know, $10 million budget. It's you know, very, you know, outside of the studio system. In general, now it's been interesting. I think the most surprising thing for us a week ago was the fact that, you know, public television stations take these interstitial ads, and we placed...
They're not ads. They're underwriting, or enhanced underwriting.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Good. thank you for that. But you know, all of the stations around the country had accepted an ad for Kinsey. Obviously, this is what we feel our target audience is. And WNET in New York rejected it with an email saying it was not because of anything in the commercial, but it was simply the content of the film and their anxiety about their viewers and calls and all of that stuff. Now once that was kind of talked about in the press, they've backtracked and said, no, it's because we don't take commercials, and which isn't really the case, I think, you know, and also because the commercial itself was too racy. But we do have that original email, and that was the first impulse. And that was a little surprising. It was the same week as Saving Private Ryan. And suddenly it felt as if these culture wars that we've all been talking about are heating up a little, you know, where people on both sides, and certainly in this case on the right, are really starting to feel that they can have an impact on these things. And it's that thing you worry about most, which is self-censorship. You know, it wasn't because people had called and complained about the commercials. It was the fact that they might. And also, obviously, the fear of the FCC that maybe had convinced this station, manager to not take the ads.
Do you feel that the campaign to prevent this movie from being made had a chilling effect on you? Did you watch what you said, or do you think you were any more cautious in showing anything sexual, or any more careful in how you presented Kinsey as a result?
You know, oddly, I think it was the opposite. I think it was I felt I had to include, for example, the scene with the pedophile had been in the movie, but it hadn't been quite so prominent.
Why don't you describe the scene for listeners who haven't seen
it? Well, this Kinsey did interview this man, an omniphile, really. I mean, he had sex with five generations of his family and 200 species of animals and hundreds of underage boys and girls. Kinsey had been in touch with him, and he had sent him books of data, and then finally sat down with him and took a 17-hour sex history. It was the longest one he ever took. And he is the source for these charges. The fact that Kinsey talked to him, did not have him arrested. I should say, I don't know that it's really to the point, but when they finally did meet, that the man was old and died less than a year later, and that activity was in the past, but still, it's sort of not really the point. The point is that Kinsey saw his role as being the father confessor of sex, and that the whole project was based on trust and anonymity. But there are people who now complain about that. I think that's legitimate. I think it's a legitimate, criticism or something to discuss. However, again, this kind of blurring of the distinction between talking to or about something and endorsing it is where I think they get into dangerous waters. You know, it's similar to people not being able to, in sex education classes today, talk about AIDS for fear that somehow they're endorsing the idea of activity that would lead to it, you know?
So you were saying you made this scene with...
it had been
this
there,
this interview
yes.
scene longer than it otherwise would have
right.
been.
Right. Dramatically, it just took on a little more weight, and I think it was because... in a way, knowing that these people are out there, I wanted to be sure to include that argument and show where it came from, and not sort of, again, I hadn't been leaving it out before, but really give it its proper weight in the movie and let you sit there and make up your own mind about how you feel about the fact that he just continues on with this interview. You know, there were discussions he had with people on his staff about using this data, and he was above all, he was interested in facts and data and what he'd collected, and you can make up your own mind about that.
We've talked a little bit about some of the criticisms against Kinsey in our time. What were the criticisms like when he was actually doing his research in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah, well, there are certain groups that were came out against him. Obviously, the attacks for the statistical methodology. Also, people like Lionel Trilling, Margaret Mead. Margaret Mead, he's taken all the fun out of sex. Lionel Trilling, where's the love? Gore Vidal today was talking about how he repeated that criticism that Trilling had made to him directly to Kinsey, and he said, "But I can't measure love. That's not what I'm about." But I think there was certainly, the Times was never a fan. And there's a certain kind of New York intellectual crowd that never really embraced Kinsey, again, thought there was something limited in the whole enterprise.
Of course, you had to face the question of how to make a movie about somebody who is very explicitly researching sex and yet get a rating that allows people to go see the movie. So can you talk a little bit about the standards you set for yourself about what to show and what not to show and why you use those standards?
Sure. The whole issue of the rating was a real challenge in two ways, I have to say. First of all, I wanted to suggest just how revolutionary Kinsey was. He marched into a classroom in the late 30s. In the context of all these hygiene films, and put up a slide of intercourse, of an erect penis and a vagina, I wanted to both be able to show that in an R-rated movie and also to suggest just how shocking that was, you know. And the second problem I approached, you know, with a kind of classic studio style of filmmaking, so that you're in this kind of pretty academic setting and you're deep into the movie and it all feels sort of traditional, and then suddenly the slide is there. And I have been pleased to see it with audiences where the gasp that happens among the students is kind of mirrored in the audience, you know, a little bit of nervous wrestling at least. But when we shot it, I was never really sure. I had to shoot a backup of just a clinical drawing because I was never sure we'd get that past the MPAA. And we sent the movie over to them, and they called after a long day of discussion and said, we're giving you an R for pervasive sexual content, and thank you. We learned a lot. So we were all relieved.
Did they explain why they didn't object to that slide?
You know, honestly, they didn't. But I can just assume it's because it's done in a clinical context that, you know, if you describe pornography as you know, the use of imagery or words to arouse, to get a sexual reaction, that clearly was not what that was doing, you know?
My guest is Bill Condon. He wrote and directed the new film Kinsey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Condon. He wrote and directed the new movie Kinsey, which is a biography of Alfred Kinsey, the scientist who researched human sexuality. These are more biographical questions about
sure.
you, but I'm wondering, like, did you have sex education when you were in school?
We did, actually. I went to a Jesuit high school, all boys, and I remember Father Duffy teaching us about 69 when I was probably 13. And it was, you know, it was in the late 60s and it was in New York, and we couldn't possibly be as students more rebellious than the faculty was at that moment, you know? So it was a very progressive school in that way. As I was saying to Gore Vidal today, the first book I think I read about sex was The Prisoner of Sex by Norman Mailer when I was probably 13. And, you know, he had lots of theories. In fact, Gore reminded me that it was over The Prisoner of Sex that the famous battle on the Dick Cavett Show happened with Norm Mailer. But one of them was, of course, my only outlet at the time, which was masturbation, that every orgasm is, you know, that doesn't, you know, isn't implanted without a condom in a woman is another chapter of the great American novel that's just been wasted. I mean, you know, he has very specific ideas about his own fluids, I think. So I can remember, you know, that's, and it's been so interesting to me later on to read about Kinsey, and he talked about, you know, Freud reinventing sin as neurosis, you know. And for me, very early on, the sense of having grown up in a devout Catholic household, you know, there was certainly a sense of sin and shame connected with sex. Then to pick up as the first book to get over that, Norm Mailer, and hear some of this, that left me completely confused.
Having made Kinsey and then being in a position like now of talking about the movie and the issues it raises publicly, have you found that there's an unbridgeable gap between people who think sex is shameful and sinful unless it's marital procreative sex and it's something that really shouldn't be discussed in public?
Yeah.
That there's an unbridgeable gap between those people and the people who think that sex is fine to talk about, it's okay to see pictures of it, it's private but not embarrassing. Do you think that those two worlds just are not communicating well and are unlikely to meet in the middle?
You know, I wouldn't have thought so up to now. I mean, I think things do get very kind of I don't know, thrown into relief by elections, for example, but it does feel as if I think it's all so complex. And, you know, I remember Pauline Kael used to write about the fact that in movies only liberals have good sex, and we all know that's not true in real life. You know, that even now, you know, these articles about where Desperate Housewives is, you know, most popular, and it's in the red states, just suggest how complicated and everybody is, you know, and everybody is individual. You know, for me, I had a great time showing this movie to a more conservative audience in St. Louis last weekend. I remember my favorite screening of Gods and Monsters was to a highly Mormon audience that were laughing complicitly with, you know, Ian McKellen as he's trying to get Brendan Fraser out of his trousers. And you got the sense that some of them would have stoned him, you know, in daylight. But here you are at nighttime, you know, in the dark, in the dream world, you know. And I think sex is deeper than politics, you know. I think it's, there's, so the unfortunate thing for me is that the real gap is the same one that Kinsey was focusing on between what we do and what we say we do, you know? So yes, maybe there is always going to be the gap between people who don't want to talk about it. I don't know truly who are the people who think there's only one way to do it, you know? And I think it'd surprise you, you know, which people feel that and which people don't.
I really like the casting in the movie, and I think Liam Neeson and Laura Linney are terrific. And just on a more trivial note, in terms of the way the film is done, Laura Linney playing Kinsey's wife is you portray the character as somebody who isn't spending a whole lot of time thinking about how she looks. You know, her clothes are kind of haphazard and lacking in style. On the other hand, they're not so screamingly lacking in style that we'd be making fun of her. She just looks like the kind of person who isn't aware of style, doesn't really care about it. And I thought it was just exactly right. I don't know if she was that way in real life or not, but I think for the character you're portraying her as being, that she was just perfectly dressed.
Well, thank you. And that's Bruce Van Leyen did the costumes, and Laura Linney, who was so intent on getting that right. And it is how she was. And it's kind of what we wanted to celebrate, you know. Again, in, you know, most movies
she wasn't
about
a vixen.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. But that's the point. It's everybody's having sex, you know, and including, you know, in movies, you don't get that sense. It's only the pretty people who are having sex, you know. But in real life, that's not the case. And so it was that, to me, one of my favorite scenes is Laura, Liam shirtless, and Peter shirtless. And before we started shooting, I said, belly's out. You know, everybody had a very ordinary body. And that's what's happening in the world.
Well, Bill Condon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Bill Condon wrote and directed the new film Kinsey, starring Liam Neeson and Laura Linney. Coming up, we remember newspaper reporter and editor Leroy Ahrens. He founded the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. This is Fresh Air. We're going to remember Leroy Ahrens, the founder and first president of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association, former executive editor of the Oakland Tribune, and former West Coast and New York correspondent for the Washington Post. He died Sunday at the age of 70. He was being treated for bladder cancer when his heart failed. I spoke with him in 1992. In 1990, just a few months before he founded the National Gay and Lesbian Journalists Association, he reported on the results of a survey of gay and lesbian journalists. He was asked to coordinate the study by the American Society of Newspaper Editors. He was chosen because he was a ranking editor, was already out at work, and was in a good position to locate other gay journalists willing to participate in the study.
So I set up a team, and we began to do that, I think rather successfully. And we did it by telephone calls, by word of mouth, by posting flyers in newsrooms, and I began to develop, for the first time in my life, a network of personal contact with gay and lesbian journalists on newspapers all over the country. And among other things, what I began to hear was a desire to connect. I called one journalist at the Providence newspaper who had heard about this, called me and was terribly excited about it, as were most of the journalists. And then he said, "Do you know anybody else at my newspaper?" And I said, "Yeah, I do, but I can't tell you because of this whole confidentiality thing." And he said, "God, is there some way that we can begin to link up and connect?" So that planted the idea in my mind. Then I delivered the results of the survey, which showed fairly predictably that there was homophobia in the newsrooms, that gay journalists perceived their own institutions doing a mediocre job in general on coverage, and that they had a sense of isolation and living in the shadows. When I delivered the results of that survey to the gathered editors, my editor peers in Washington in 1990, I had to make a decision. Do I come out publicly nationally or do I not? And in retrospect, I made a decision to say, yes, I'm a gay man and an editor, and I'm proud of ASNE for accomplishing this.
Do you think that there are any unique problems that a journalist has in coming out?
Yes, there are. One is there are possible career implications. Secondly, there is the question of perception. They face the possibility that they may be seen as representing some kind of a special interest, and they struggle with this issue, the advocacy versus the objectivity. And it's a new experience because while Afro-American journalists banded together in associations 15, 17 years ago, Hispanics and the rest, gays and lesbians are just experimenting with this. I think what they're beginning to learn is that they need to make the argument that they insist upon being seen as professionals who've been in this business for years and years, doing competent, excellent jobs with high professional journalistic standards. That does not end just because you come out and be totally who you are.
You decided to come out nationally when you were giving the results of the survey that you were commissioned to do. Was that a hard choice?
It was a difficult choice. I had come out in 83 at my own newspaper in the Tribune when I came on to my first job there. That was a tough move as well because I'd been in journalism for 34 years now, and 24 of them I lived as a closeted person and a closeted professional, living in fear that someone would spot me going into a bar and that it would have some impact on a kind of personal rejection or perhaps some career implications. In making that decision before hundreds of peer editor colleagues, the night before I was to deliver the findings, the text of my statement did not have my coming out statement in it. I woke up the next morning and began to think, here I am talking about other gay and lesbian journalists living in the shadows, and I'm going. I just can't walk up there and pretend that I am something that I'm not. So I added the words that I described before at the end. And interestingly, there was a subtext that kind of echoed internally for me, reflexively, which was, "Here I am, world, all of me at last." So I have to tell you that these are not easy decisions, both in terms of professional issues and in terms of personal issues.
I'm wondering if in this group that you created, if you feel that there are a lot of journalists who are much more radical in their approach to gay issues and gay rights than you are, and if so, how you feel about that, if that makes you uncomfortable or not.
Well, I guess that there probably are journalists in our group who would view me as being someone on the conservative side of the spectrum. And we've had discussions constantly within our organization, and I think these are legitimate discussions as to, how do you serve your role as a member of your journalistic craft, and at the same time deal with your responsibility to these issues. I have to say that I probably started out a lot more conservative than I am now in building the organization with the many colleagues who have helped to do this, work together with them, and in exposing myself to a lot of information and a lot of study and examination that I hadn't before. I think that it's moved me a little bit toward the left and perhaps some of my colleagues a little bit more toward the center.
What issues do you feel you've moved on?
Well, I think that I've begun to get a broader perspective on the role of a gay journalist in the press. I think that, to hide behind the notion of objectivity in the face of injustice seems to me to be just that, to be hiding. I think that one of the traditions of journalism is to fight injustice, to work in behalf of the underdog. And I guess the other thing that's been happening to me is the more I read about and experience and watch the effort to force gays back into the closet, the fact that homosexuality is one of the last places where scapegoating is considered permissible, I start to feel some passion about this that may have been suppressed before, to be perfectly honest with you.
Leroy Ahrens recorded in 1992. He died Sunday at the age of 70. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the Israeli writer Amos Oz about growing up in Jerusalem in the 1940s and 50s. His new book, A Tale of Love and Darkness, is part memoir, part fiction. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.